Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. The show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Saturday, September 1st, 2018. This is episode 1519. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Flexible and entertaining training for your IT career. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And by Qualcomm Snapdragon. According to Ookla, Android smartphones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm had faster data speeds on AT&T and T-Mobile than non-Android phones with Intel modems, based on over a million real-world tests done in Q2 2018. See all the data for yourself at qualcomm.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet. We talk about home theater. Scott Wilkinson's coming up, actually, in just a little bit. We talk about, smartphones. We talk about smartwatches, augmented reality, anything with a chip in it. That's what this show is all about, technology, the way it's changing our world. The way it changes how we work and we live and we play, the way it makes us crazy when it doesn't work. That's what it's all about on the Tech Guy Show. Smartphones will be the topic, I think, over the next month, because it is precious close to Apple. This is Apple month. September, yeah, not only real Apples, but Apple computer month. This is when the new iPhones come out. It's a holiday for geeks. We're still, you know, waiting to hear. Apple's pretty good about keeping things quiet, although as you get closer and closer to the release of the next generation iPhone, there are leaks. You know, they come out of the factory, for one thing, leaks. The people who are making the phone. And they, you know, in order to get the iPhone out, this month, there are a number of factories cranking as fast as they can. Honhai, which makes the iPhone, Foxconn, has been almost certainly making this phone since August, maybe even longer, so at least a month. Because, typically you've got to sell 2 or 3 million in the first week. You got to have them ready. They have to be on the ship, on the way. In fact, probably, be my guess, they'll be on the boat soon. Maybe they don't do a boat. Come to think of it, I think they do a 747, just a belly full of iPhones. So here's what we know. Here's what we think. I believe that the iPhone event will be September 12th. I have my crystal ball. I believe it will be September 12th because they don't want to do September 11th. They've done September 12th before a Wednesday. If they do it on September 12th, then the Friday following, you'll be able to pre-order. What will you be able to pre-order? Well, with my magic crystal, I'm looking ahead. I'm thinking three different models. This is the consensus of all the rumors so far. Three different models. One, relatively inexpensive, maybe $700, somewhere around there. LCD-based version. That's the screen technology. So it'll be a little bit smaller, the size of an iPhone 8. One middle size, it'll be a little bit bigger, but not really perceptibly so, than the iPhone 10. That'll have an OLED, Super AMOLED screen. We know that because Apple's bought screens from Samsung and LG for these phones. And then a third iPhone that'll be bigger than the other two, bigger than any iPhone ever before, almost the biggest phone out there right now, 6.4 inches. That's what I'm thinking, 6.4 inch iPhone. We don't know what the names will be. Lately, Apple's been saying, it might not be the iPhone 10 Plus. We thought iPhone 10S and 10 Plus, and then some, I don't know what for the smaller iPhone. Maybe some colors for the smaller iPhone. Apple likes that idea of a little bit something colorful. if it's a color phone, it'd be colorful around the edge. The current iPhone 10, which is, by the way these will all be is like the iPhone 10 with Face ID, no more home button, no more fingerprint ID. You know, all the features of the iPhone 10, including the new user interface design. iOS 12 will be coming out at the same time, and there's some nice new features there. I've been using that, the public beta of that, for a couple of months, and I really quite like it. Biggest thing on the software of the new iPhones will be these Siri shortcuts, where the iPhone, in conjunction with other apps on your phone, kind of notices, for instance, oh, you always come to work at 8 in the morning and stop off at Phil's Coffee to get a mojito latte. So maybe I'll say that. I'll suggest that, and maybe you'd like me to order it from the Phil's Coffee app automatically. That's a Siri suggestion. It'll come in the notifications. You'll say yes, as a matter of fact. You'll press OK. And then every morning, the iPhone will say, OK, you're on your way to work. You want me to order that coffee now? And you'll say yes. There'll also be a Shortcuts app. This is replacing the app that's currently out called Workflow. Apple bought this last year. And that will allow you to create your own actions. I've done a few of them, and I really like it. It's a really nice feature. Remains to be seen whether normal people are going to do scripting. You know, that's what this basically is, programming the phone. It's a hard thing to do, but that'll be the biggest, I think, new feature in iOS 12. So three new phones, two of them with OLED screens, all three of them looking somewhat like an iPhone 10. The less expensive $700 version will, I'm, by the way, making that number up completely, pulling it out of thin air. Maybe it'll be $599, I don't know. Will have a more colorful aluminum outer bezel, you know, frame. Maybe a little more color choice in the glass back as well. All of them will have wireless charging. So let's see, if $700 for the inexpensive one, $850 for the middle-sized one. That'll be the starting price, of course, if you get more storage, more memory or something. Pay more for. I guess you can't get more memory on an iPhone, can't you? They don't even mention how much memory is in these things, but you could get more storage, more disk space. Yeah, let's see. So $700, $850, and then will Apple hold at $1,000 for the iPhone 10 Plus, the big one? I bet they'll go to $1,100. I think they're going to test the waters on the above $1,000 price point. If you order them on the 14th, and as usual, Apple will open the online store at midnight Pacific time on the 14th in a couple of weeks, and then delivery the following Friday, September 21st. I like to put these down before it happens, just so you can rate my accuracy. That's my prediction. Three new iPhones. There will also be, and I know some people are interested, I think almost certainly new iPads, which will also lose the home button. They'll have Face ID. I don't know how they're going to implement that, because iPads you tend to use sideways. I don't know what's going to happen there. We'll find out. Those will be iPad Pros. They'll use the pencil. I am also thinking, and I haven't heard any rumors to this effect, but I'm thinking because they're clearance priced, they will replace the AirPods. Those are the wireless in-ear headphones that Apple's been selling. They've been very popular. They're very easy to lose. I've already lost two pairs. I'm not buying a third pair because I just keep losing them. But I feel like Apple's going to announce new AirPods as well this month. So all of that, I'm going to say it again, pure speculation based on what others have said, what rumors have come out, mostly rumors from what we call the supply chain, the manufacturers in China. But I feel fairly confident about all of that. You can rate me in a couple of weeks, see if I got it right or wrong. The only thing I can say for sure is today would be a very bad time to buy an iPhone, an iPad, or any Apple product. Let's wait at least a couple of weeks. We're going to take a break. And then it's your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. And we say hello to Mike in Dana Point, California. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Leo.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. The reason why I'm calling is I wanted to upgrade my old Mac 2012 i7 with a 2.6 gigahertz processor with a new SSD drive.
Okay.
So I got super duper. I cloned it to nice. A backup drive.
Good choice.
SSD in. It's 2 terabytes. Worked flawlessly for 2 years.
Uh-oh.
I mean, 1 year. Sorry, 1 year.
Yeah.
Then I went to backup with super duper, and they're saying your hard drive is going bad. Replace your hard drive. It's still covered under warranty. So far, okay. I called the hard drive manufacturer. They said, if that's the case, and we get it back and the hard drive is not failing, and it's a software problem, then you're going to owe us $550.
Whoa!
SSD drive.
Whoa. So where is the warning coming from? Super duper?
Super duper. Their tech support.
Interesting. So, yeah, but it's not coming from the hard drive itself. It's coming from a third party. That's why the company. Who made the hard drive?
Crucial.
So Crucial, you should, first thing I would do is ask Crucial or go to the Crucial website, see if they have their own hard drive testing software.
I did.
Okay.
And so let me tell you what they did. So they said, hey, you don't have the right firmware. You know, so I went down, got a CD, burnt it, put it on there, updated the firmware, deleted the file that Super Duper said was bad, redid it again. And sure enough, it failed again.
Wow.
And Super Duper sent me back an email and said, yes, your hard drive is definitely failing. So to hedge my bet, I went down to the Genius Bar at Apple just a short while ago.
Good.
I said, could you test my hard drive?
Good idea. But I bet they said, no, because it's not an Apple hard drive.
No, they tested it, right?
They did. Good for them. That was nice of them. Okay.
It was. And they said, guess what? It looks like your hard drive's fine. And I said, well, I'm in a pickle now because I can't back it up using Super Duper. And they are very insistent through multiple emails that this hard drive is starting to fail. And if I gamble wrong here, Crucial says I'm going to owe them $550.
And it's an SSD, right? Solid state drive.
Correct. Yeah.
So I think the Super Duper warning is suspicious, and I'll tell you why. The way solid-state drives work is not at all like spinning drives work. On a spinning drive, you know, Super Duper is trying to back it up. It says, hey, you know, this sector, I can't read this sector. I know there's data on it. I can't read it. There's something wrong with it. A solid-state drive uses something called wear leveling to avoid wearing out any given cell. Its drive geometry is completely different from a spinning drive. And furthermore, if that sector is bad, they'll map it out and just won't use it. So I'll be honest, I am suspicious of the Super Duper warning. Now, I understand that puts you in a conundrum because you like Super Duper. You want to keep using it. It's a great piece of software from Shirt Pocket Software. And have you been in touch with them with a real human or just an automated?
It's just the emails coming back, and they're very personal emails. They're saying it's starting to fail. And then the last email came back, your hard drive is failing. You know, you may want to replace this sooner now than later.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure I trust that.
Okay.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. Because presumably, I don't know what Apple has, but
MacTool Pro looked like it was what they were using. I couldn't tell.
MacTool Pro is a very common hard drive testing utility. But it's not definitive.
Right.
Wonder what Super Duper is seeing. So there's something called Smart.
Yep.
Do they mention Smart?
I've got it, I think, active on my...
Yeah, it stands for Self-Monitoring Analysis and Reporting Technology. It's something that kind of keeps an eye on the drives. And the theory is it's supposed to detect hard drive failure before it happens. The problem with Smart is it's not that smart. And in fact, hard drive manufacturers made sure it wasn't that smart. So, not all SSDs have smart, but I'm guessing that's the only way Super Duper would know. I would see if you can find a third-party SSD testing utility, maybe MacTool Pro, or maybe see if there's a smart utility.
Now, the Genius guy gave me a tip. He says, here's what you can do. He said, why don't you get a comparable software to Super Duper, like Carbon Cloner?
Yeah, Carbon Copy Cloner is one, and the other one is from it's called ChronoSync. There are other programs that do what Super Duper does.
And he says it's free for 30 days. And
yeah.
Do it with that.
Yeah,
you
know, Carbon Copy Cloner predated Super Duper, and it really was the recommendation for years. I prefer Super Duper, but that's not a bad idea. What we want is a second opinion. But what's frustrating is Super Duper won't work anymore for you.
Right. That's exactly right.
Strange. What I'm trying to think of, first of all, $500 is ridiculous because you can replace the drive for less than that.
Right.
So what Crucial is effectively telling you is, no, we don't want to see it.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's a crazy gamble. You'd be cheaper just to buy a new drive. So that's a gamble that doesn't make any sense. And the only reason I think I can't imagine that it doesn't cost them that much to see.
Right.
Yeah, try Carbon Copy Cloner, BOMBICH.com. I don't know why I've never seen Super Duper do this, by the way. I've used Super Duper for years. I've never seen it say, nope, not going to do it. Your drive's in trouble. It's dying. And I don't even know why it's dying. Maybe it must. The other thing to see is if there's a third-party Mac tool that detects smart. I don't know if there is. There are plenty of Windows tools that do, but I don't know. Apple's doesn't. A lot of these Apples don't have a lot of tooling, only because most Mac users don't really worry about that stuff.
Does it help you if I tell you the name of the support person and what he's saying?
The support person at Crucial?
At
SharePocket. Oh, so you have talked to somebody at SharePocket?
No, it's just
email. Email.
Yeah.
No, I don't know the guys over there.
Okay.
Wonder why it's...
It says input-output error.
Yeah.
Due to input-output error.
Yeah, that's not a hard drive issue. That's probably the controller. Maybe the controller is having problems, but that's the Macintosh. There is circuitry, I guess, on the SSD. I've never heard of this, and I'm not sure what. I certainly wouldn't send it to Crucial. I would do what HAL 9000 suggested in the movie 2001.
All right,
Dave. I suggest we put the unit back in operation and let it fail. Make sure you got a good backup. You can use Carbon Copy Cloner since Super Duper won't cooperate. And see if it fails. And if it doesn't fail in the next month or so, it's a spurious error.
Got it.
That's very odd. There are Crucial utilities. You might see if you can download them from the Crucial website.
When I called them, they said I needed a Windows machine.
Yeah, darn it. Yeah, this is the problem with owning a Mac. Because it just works, right? Why would you ever need a tool, a replacement, a fix? Could be a drive cable. I don't know. I would just see if it fails. And make sure you have a good backup. Carbon Copy Cloner or ChronoSync, both are good. Leo Laporte. That's a fascinating one. The tech guy. Leo Laporte, as usual, this time of the show, we like to get our home theater guru in. Scott Wilkinson's editor at avsforum.com, joins us every week to talk about big screen TVs, surround sound, Atmos, movies, and the like. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I am very well. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
You have some questions from the audience to answer, I think.
Do, yes. Frank Ireland has written and said he just recently bought a Sony TV to replace an LG TV that died. And he also has an LG home theater system called the LHB976.
Mm.
And one of the reasons that he likes that, he bought that home theater system with the LG TV. And he's now trying to use the HDMI ARC function. ARC stands for Audio Return Channel. And it's really pretty cool. If you take an HDMI cable and you plug it into the HDMI out of this home theater in a box or any AVR receiver or whatever, you plug it into one of the HDMI inputs on the TV, if both devices are... compatible or support this ARC, audio return channel, then audio from the TV can be sent back to the AV receiver, or in this case, the home theater in a box system, from the cable that normally sends data from the other way, So it's basically sending data backwards along one cable back to the audio system so that you can hear it over your audio, your speakers and so on, don't have to use the TV speakers.
So this is something that we didn't really need when all of the sources for the television were coming from outside the television.
Correct.
But now that the TV is smart, which I'm still not sure I like, but now that the TV can generate its own stuff, you need some way to get, you're getting the picture from the TV, but you need to get some way to get the audio back into your sound system.
And the way that we used to have to do it was to take, say, an optical digital audio cable and connect it from the TV back to the sound system.
People still do that with soundbars, right?
A lot of people do. Yeah, a lot of people. With soundbars, that's the way to do it. Although some soundbars do have this HDMI ARC on them.
And you plug your
Blu-ray player, your gaming console, your streaming box like Roku, whatever, into the soundbar. And then everything goes via HDMI to the TV. And if the TV is supplying you with content, like from its own internal streaming apps or even its own internal tuner, if you're getting over-the-air broadcast, then that audio can go back to the soundbar or the home theater in a box on the same cable that otherwise sends stuff to the TV. So this is called ARC. And he hasn't been able to get it to work.
Oh. You know, I get calls like this all the time. I'm so glad you're addressing this. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's a couple things to think about. One is you need what's called a high-speed HDMI cable. You need a pretty modern HDMI cable that supports this. The other thing that both devices need to have is something called CEC, Consumer Electronics Control. Now, the Sony TV has it. I've been looking around on this LG home theater in a box, which I otherwise wasn't familiar with, and I didn't see that explicitly, but I assume it does. It was advertised as having ARC, and if it has ARC, it has to have CEC. Okay, so you need a high-speed HDMI cable. You need to plug it into the correct HDMI input on the TV, which is clearly labeled. I think it's HDMI 3 on this Sony X850 TV, 850E. It says parentheses ARC. So that's the one you want to plug it into.
Next to the actual socket, there's a little thing that says HDMI 3 ARC. Yeah.
Yep, okay. Yep, exactly. So you need to find that particular input, and that's the input you're going to go to. Then you need to make sure that both devices are – that the ARC is turned on. So, for example, in the TV, you need to go into the settings and you need to go into the HDMI control menu and make sure the control is set to on.
Hmm.
It may or may not be by default. I haven't looked at that on that particular TV. But you have to make sure that it's on because otherwise it won't work. So this may be his problem, I'm guessing at this point. But that's one thing that could go.
Yeah, I didn't know you had to enable it. I thought it was just always there.
It may be on by default.
Right.
But if it –
I
would definitely go in and check. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It might not be. So you definitely want to go in and check. Now, he has decided to – basically plug everything into his TV, the other HDMI inputs. So his Blu-ray player and his satellite box, I think, are plugged into the TV. Now, the problem is, and I haven't yet been able to determine whether this is true, the ARC is really meant for the TV's internal apps, like its Netflix app or Prime Video app or whatever, or its internal tuner. I'm not 100% sure that it's going to mirror the audio coming into one of its HDMI inputs back out ARC.
ARC is really intended for content created on the TV, not stuff coming into the TV from other sources.
Correct.
So how do you handle that?
Well, there may be no way to
split it.
You could split it. That would be one way to do it.
Lip sync might suffer, right?
It might. HDMI splitters do exist, and they're not that expensive, 50 bucks, something along those lines.
So it would split it into HDMI for the television and some sort of audio for the
correct or a second HDMI output.
Okay,
going into this LG home theater in a box has two HDMI inputs, I believe, and he has more than two devices.
Now, Mike Heiss is in, your colleague from ABS Forum is in the chat room.
Yeah.
And he says something that actually I did not know that maybe will help me answer this question in the future. Some ARC outputs are two-channel PCM. Some are bitstream. In other words, right. What you're getting back is may not always – so what is the difference?
Well, PCM is uncompressed digital data. It's exactly the same digital data that you find on a CD.
It's the stereo sound.
It's the stereo sound. It could be multi-channel, but more often than not, it's stereo sound, and it's uncompressed.
Right.
And unencoded, whereas Bitstream is encoded in something like Dolby Digital.
Oh, so you may need a decoder on the other end to understand what you're getting.
Exactly.
Oh.
And that was the last point I was going to make here, is that you may need to set the TV to output PCM. Because the LG Home Theater box may not accept Bitstream, Dolby Digital, DTS, whatever, via ARC.
That may also be true of a soundbar. A lot of devices
correct.
Don't understand these. You know, if it doesn't say Dolby decoding built in.
Right, right.
It may say, oh, I know, I need just regular bit. I mean, you know.
PCM,
it's funny. Bitstream sounds like what it's not. It sounds like the opposite.
Exactly.
Bitstream sounds like just plain old music. But it's not. It's an encoded data
encoded.
Stream. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly
and PCM right. is an unencoded, just musical stream.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And it's still digital, though. It's
it
still
is.
Bits.
They're both digital.
Yeah.
But with a bit stream, you need a decoder.
Ah.
And with PCM, you don't. So
can you buy a standalone Dolby decoding device that we plug it into?
Not that I know of.
They're mostly in AV receivers, things like that.
Okay, Mike Heiss in the chat room is just saying, I don't think any Bitstream on ARC.
Oh.
Bitstream is an EARC function, which is enhanced ARC, which is coming in HDMI 2.1.
Well, whatever we just said, forget it. And we'll talk again next week. I don't know. This is the problem with all this stuff. It's a mess, and no wonder people are confused. Scott Wilkinson's at avsforum.com. So is Mike, and he joins us each week. Thank you, Scott. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We go back to the phones on the line here. It's Susie, Spring Hill, Florida. Hello, Susie.
Hello there, Leo, my angel.
Oh.
Answer my question.
Well, you're my angel because you've been hanging on, and I appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Oh, honey, you don't know how painful it was. I have Parkinson's disease, and I had a stroke. And,
I'm so sorry.
Spinal cord surgery, and I'm hurting so bad, but I ain't hanging up. I can't believe I got through.
Next time you tell Kim, you say, put me on right now. Leo said, Susie has the front-of-the-line privilege. I am sorry. Thank you for holding on. I'm sorry.
I loved your singing earlier. Don't rock the boat. Yeah, I remember them songs.
The good old disco days. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The mashed potato, yeah.
Well, that's a little older than that. Yeah, I remember that, too. What can I do for you, Susie?
Amazon stick, because everybody's saying, get rid of your internet, because on disability, I can't afford it.
Oh, shoot.
They were outrageous, the price, and then they said, $29.99, you can get the Wi-Fi. That's all you need, so I put that on it. And then when I called them up and told them to cancel the internet, I got Wi-Fi. And they said, well, the Wi-Fi now goes up to $69.99.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these cable companies are notorious.
But that's still half the price of what I was paying for the internet. And now when I've got this
So basically what happened is, as soon as you said, I don't want cable TV from you, I just want internet from you, they raised the price on the internet. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Fire Stick, but it has, you know, a lot of problems with it going in and out. And
it's not my favorite. I can tell you some better ones. It's the nice thing about the Fire Stick is cheap.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was $59.99 or something with the Home Shopping Club. It was the good one, the four something. I don't know nothing about all these things, but the guy on there said this is the secret. You buy this rabbit ears, the antenna thing. Mofu or something like that, and you put that on with it, and it will get all your local channels in clear and all. I haven't had my son hook that up yet, but his friend kept telling him, oh, you don't need it, you don't need it.
So are you, you're in Spring Hill. Is that near a big city?
Tampa. We ain't far from Tampa, 40 minutes.
All right. So what they're saying is, and this is true, the best deal in television is free TV. Remember, we remember those days? Free TV that broadcast it through the air. As long as you're close enough to the TV stations in Tampa, you could get all of them. All you need is an antenna. And that's great because that's free once you get the antenna. And then you use a Fire Stick for things like, you know, you can get Netflix on them or HBO if you want it or Hulu or whatever. But but that's going to cost you, you know, some of those are going to cost you additional price.
Yeah, well, they want you to, everything wants you to get the Amazon. That's like $150 and the Netflix is like $30 or something.
Yeah, no, Netflix is probably the best one for you. It's about $10 a month.
Yeah.
That's kind of an unlimited amount of stuff you can watch.
Yeah. Okay, I was just wondering what you were thinking about those antennas.
Yeah. The thing to do, and so you got somebody helping you out here.
Oh, yeah.
Have them.
Use my hands.
Yeah. So there are a couple of websites. My favorite is called TV Fool. TVFool.com. Yeah. And you enter in your zip code, your address, and it'll tell you if you can get those TV stations. Because otherwise, until you get the antenna, you don't know. And so you're not right in Tampa. If you were in Tampa, I'd say, well, of course you can get them. But you're far enough out of Tampa that it might be a weaker signal. I don't know. So if you go to TV Fool, it's free. There's actually a section. See which TV stations you can get.
Okay.
And that'll tell you, and then it'll also give you some advice on what kind of antenna you'll need. So it's often the case that as you get farther from the city, you can get it, but you need an antenna that can aim at the tower and that kind of thing. So it'll give you a TV signal locator, and it will give you an idea of what kind of antenna you might need to have it work. It's a really good site for, we call people like you cord cutters.
Cord cutters,
because you're cutting off the cable TV, and you're going to do it over the internet. But, you know, these guys see you coming, these cable companies, and they charge. I can't believe they doubled the cost of your internet just because you weren't buying TV. That's terrible. They don't. You know, you're still a customer. You're still paying them a good monthly amount of money.
Taking on old people, yeah.
That's rude.
Money out of me, yeah.
Rude. What's the name of your cable company?
What is that? Broad Stripe?
Well,
Broad Stripe.
Darn you, Broad Stripe.
Oh, they changed. It's Spectrum or something.
It's Spectrum. Yeah, it's Spectrum now. It was Time Warner and the Roadrunner, and now it's Spectrum. Darn you, Spectrum. You dirty rat. Susie deserves better. Darn you.
All right, I'm going to try TVFool.com.
Yeah, although somebody, Turtle, who's in the chat.
Number two.
Yeah, he's in our chat room. He says he lives 9 miles south of you. And he says you're going to have a hard time in Spring Hill getting the channels in Tampa. You're just a little too far away. So TV Fool will tell you that, but I suspect that so that's the whole deal, is the antenna is a great deal if you can pick it up. That's why cable TV exists, is for all the people who are outside the range. We live far enough. We're about 45 minutes from San Francisco, up here in Petaluma in the Sonoma County. Just far enough, I can't get any of the San Francisco TV stations. I can only get one station up here. So an antenna doesn't help me at all. That's why cable exists, right? So that was the original idea, is they would put up a big antenna in the early days, put up a big antenna, and then you have a cable off of it, and you could get the reception because the antenna was so big. Then eventually they did deals with it all became digital, and they did deals with the local TV stations, and they carry it that way, but, you know, through the internet. But, in the old days it was a big antenna. That was the whole idea of cable. I'm sorry to, you know, check TV Fool anyway, but it sounds like you're not going to get over-the-air stuff in Spring Hill. You're far enough away from Tampa. Oh, nuts. Back on the line now, Ryan in Anaheim. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
Wonderful. How you?
I'm doing pretty good. I have the phone finished because of you.
Uh-oh. what kind of phone fetish?
I think you remember me. I had the S6, and I got a check back from Samsung a couple weeks ago.
Oh, good.
And I've been looking at the HTC U11 Lite and the new U12.
Yeah.
And I still hunt off you on my Note 8, but then it's like I have this fetish because I've always loved my HTC.
I love the HTCs. I am not going to recommend them anymore. The company laid off. Whoa, it's a little noisy out there. Company laid off a bunch of people recently. They're floundering. They had the worst month last month they've ever had. People are not buying their phones, and it's nothing wrong with their phones. They're nice phones, but you don't want to buy a phone from a company that's floundering because you aren't going to get the support you deserve. If you're going to get an Android device, I'd either get it from Google. Those Pixels now are on sale because they've got new ones coming out in a couple of months. So the Pixel 2s are very nice, the Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL. Samsung's still great. I know you like your Samsungs. That's still a great choice. I guess my third choice there would be the Motorolas. If you don't want to spend a lot of money, the G6s, the new Motorolas, are very nice. All of them are updated regularly. They're fairly pure Android, at least the Motorola's and the Google's are. Samsung, it's the Samsung experience, but that's not a bad experience. You like it. But yeah, I'd stay away from HTC. I feel like they're struggling right now. And I don't know what the prognosis is, but it ain't good. Plus, Google hired away all their engineers. That's another problem. Hey, nice to talk to you. Thanks for hanging on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up after news at the top of the hour. We'll be back with more of the Tech Guy in just a bit. But first, a word from the folks who make this all possible, IT Pro TV. Oh, man, we love IT Pro TV. I know Tim and Don practically, I guess I even met them before they started it. They were IT trainers for a long time, helping people get the certifications they need to get a job in IT. And they went to a NAB panel that I was on talking about what we do at TWIT. And Tim looks at Don, and Don looks at Tim, and they say, You know, what if we did this for IT training? And IT Pro TV was born. The good news is, thank you, IT Pro TV. They started advertising with TWIT right away, and I think we've helped them become very successful, and rightly so. Rightly so. IT is a great profession. There are many jobs open. I heard that there were 1 million openings right now, today, openings right now in IT security alone. Alone. So how do you get into this field? Well, unfortunately, experience doesn't necessarily help. If you've been working in it, okay. But, you know, just because you know and understand this, you've been doing it at home or whatever, doesn't mean you get that job. What they really want is the certifications. And that's why you take the training to get the certs so you can get the job. But IT Pro TV does more than that. Not only does it help you get the certs, but it helps you keep your skills up to date once you're already an IT professional. In fact, I know many IT professionals who continue to use IT Pro TV to learn. You don't really need, I think you might think I need a degree in computer science to get a job. Let me tell you about that. Glassdoor just did a list of 15 top employers. That includes Google and Apple that no longer require college degrees. They've realized that's not really a good predictor of skill. These companies are looking at candidates who have hands-on experience through a coding boot camp or industry-related training like IT Pro TV. This is what you need. And it's a lot less than a college, a lot less than a technical school. Really, in some ways, a lot less than just buying the material and doing it on your own. From CompTIA to Cisco to the EC Council and VMware, IT Pro TV has you covered with everything you need to launch or grow your IT career. They've been doing this a while now. They have 4,000 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training. Somebody sent me an email the other day saying, you know what, Leo, you say binge-worthy. It really is. I can't stop watching. Wasn't it nice to learn from something that you enjoy? New content is added every day. They have live videos. They're doing Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, about 125 hours of live content every week that they then turn into, you know, their on-demand training. Courses are listed by category or certification or job role, so it's easy to find the course you want to take. You can watch on your computer, of course, or your smartphone. They have great apps on iOS and Android. But they also have apps for Chromecast, for Roku, for Amazon Fire TV, for Apple TV, a beautiful Apple TV app. I guess it's not a Chromecast app. The Android and iOS apps have Chromecast built in. That's how it works. If you manage a team, IT Pro TV offers flexible online training for IT teams of all sizes, too. Their Pro Portal is great. Keeps your... you know, your team's training schedule. You can set assignments. You can check how they're doing, logins, viewing time, courses viewed, tracks completed. Really great way to keep your IT team's skills up to date. Interactive training they'll enjoy watching. I mean, come on. Engaging hosts. And it's a talk show format. It's a lot like what we do here at TWIT. You know, September 18th is National IT Professionals Day. Let's celebrate with an IT Pro TV subscription. Now 100,000 IT Pro TV members strong, 100,000, and we knew them when they first began. They're doing so great. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and find out why. You can learn about their pro solution, the team solution. You can request a team trial, and of course, you can sign up for a membership for yourself. Individual monthly memberships, which include, by the way, a free 7-day trial, are available at itpro.tv/techguy. And when you do sign up, use the offer code TG30. And that way you'll get 30% off your monthly subscription as long as you stay active forever. Standard subscriptions are normally $570 a year. I consider that still very reasonable. But you only pay $399 when you get the offer code TG30. What? That is such a good deal. itpro.tv/techguy. What do we say? Flexible training. Binge-worthy content, life-changing results. itpro.tv/techguy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Welcome back to the show. I'm going to go right to the phone. Let's just go right to the phones. What do you say? Line one is Paul in Los Angeles. Thanks for hanging on, Paul.
Glad I could.
Yay. What can I do for
Thanks
you?
Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
In your earlier episode, you were conversing with someone who was using Handbrake and ripping DVDs, and I wanted to add an add-on to that, and
oh,
then
please.
I had a question of my own.
Good. I'd love to get expert feedback, because I haven't ripped a DVD in years.
I'm a Mac guy in L.A. I help people with their Macintosh technology.
Oh, nice. So
I literally was helping someone 2 days ago, and he whipped out of his pocket a flash drive that's called an iDisk with two Ks.
Yes.
That's 128 gigabytes that can plug into his iPad.
Yes.
Or it could plug into his computer.
It has a flash connector. It has a lightning connector.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen that, but I thought that was a nice add-on to the previous conversation.
So if you plug it in using the lightning connector to your iPad or iPhone,
it has its own software.
Ah, okay, because that's the trick. Is
on the iPad.
You can put something there, but there's no point if the iPad can't see it. So it has special software that can read it off of there.
Right. You download that software from the App Store, and then it can go take a look at the drive and what files are on there.
So this guy had a bunch of DVDs, and they were kids' DVDs. I remember doing this for my kids. First thing I did was I would take Bambi, and this was back in the VHS tape days. It wasn't a DVD. My kids are old enough now. And I edited out the bad stuff in Bambi. Yes, there's a bad scene in Bambi. So I edited that out. The kids were little enough, they didn't notice any continuity problems. Where'd mommy go? I don't know. She's off. She's having some food. She's fine. And then I would put it on another format. Usually I would put it on a flash drive or a hard drive so that they could play it back and not wear the disc out. And that's exactly what he wants to do. He said that his Chrysler minivan will play back SD cards, but this would be great for an iPad. And that way you don't have to put it on the iPad. In fact, I should get this for my trip. 128 gigabytes, that's a lot of movies.
Yeah. And I think I breezed by Amazon. I think it's like 110, 115.
I'm looking at it right now. $62.89.
Oh.
And it's USB 3, which means you'll be able to copy the movies over very quickly. It has a Type A connector on one end and then the Lightning connector on the other end.
Isn't that cool?
Wow. I'm ordering right now. That would be very handy.
So now my question to stump you.
Yes.
I have went online and we saw the newer Phantom movie, and I went online and I bought a DVD of the newest Phantom of the Opera play.
Okay.
As a DVD. And okay. When it arrives, it's a PAL.
Ah, because it's in Europe.
Right.
Yep.
And now I have a Samsung DVD player.
Yeah.
That I've read online that there's some controls that you can do to throw it into universal mode where it'll ignore.
Yeah. So there's this thing called region code.
Right.
That the hoops companies jump through to keep piracy at bay, none of which stops pirates at all.
Right.
I mean, and honestly, a pirate goes, oh, yeah, fine, region coding, big deal. But everybody normal like you orders a disc and it's in, you know, it's region coded for Europe, which is the case probably with this one. And you can't play it on your regular DVD player. The way many DVD players work, the first time you use a DVD, you effectively set the region code. So you use a US-based DVD, suddenly it's region one and nothing else will play in it. But there are DVD players that are multi-region, code-free, and I don't know about yours, and there are often back doors into DVD players involving number presses on the remote control, things like that, to unlock them.
And I tried that, but part of the problem is I also have an Insignia television, which responds to that.
Oh, curse you, Hollywood. All right, so which Samsung player do you have? Were you able to remove region coding on the player?
You're supposed to be able to. I wasn't able to press those keys to make it work. Maybe what I need to do is just completely disconnect it from that TV.
That's right. That's right. Disconnect it from the TV or connect it to a different TV and run the process. It'll be up, up, down, down, left, right, that kind of thing. Region, then you'll usually get a special menu. I mean, it just depends. You can Google this. Yep. Just put the model number in and say remove region code, and you'll find it.
Now, I was going to say the other thing is I also have an iMac, and I have the Apple DVD Super Drive. And I remember years ago with the Apple laptops, after you played five times, it set it. But there used to be a code to reset it.
Right. See, the DVD player guys really would love you to play whatever you got. Right. Hollywood says, well, you can't make that thing. We won't license that thing unless you make sure the region codes are locked. Mm-hmm. So there's usually some engineer at the factory says, I can take care of that, boss. And so there's backdoors galore and all of this stuff. I just don't know. I can't. A, I don't know what it is. B, it'd be no point in me giving it to you over the air. You really got to find a website because it's going to be complicated. So I'll give you an example. Archandra in our chat room has an Apex 3201 DVD player, which is Apex is made in China. It's actually a very good DVD player. He says what you do is you eject whatever's in the disc, enter 8421 on the remote, and then you'll get a hidden menu. It's going to be like that.
Yeah.
If you have a disc that you can play on a Mac, the PAL format will not be the problem.
Okay.
Because VLC will read it. It's just the thing about PAL, it's a different frame rate. That's all. And you can easily rip it and convert it. Converting the format is not going to be the problem. It's reading it.
Right.
Because of region coding. Yeah. Yeah. So NTSC is 30 frames a second. We're all used to that. But PAL, which is used in far more countries, actually, than NTSC, which is our standard, it's 25 frames a second. So if you play back on a NTSC DVD player, 25 frames a second, it'll look like it's in slow motion. So you don't want to do that. But it's easy to fix in software. Digitally, you can fix that. There's no problem. So, yeah, you have two problems you have to solve. Worst case, you can often bring these to a conversion facility.
Right.
And say, I want to make this. And you live in L.A., which means they're all over the place. This is sad because it doesn't stop pirates. Pirates go, yeah, whatever. They have the whole work chain all. If you ever go to China, you go in the basement of a department store. Every game, every movie, every bit of content you'd ever want, openly displayed with the actual art from the original, just sitting there in the basement. You can buy anything you want for a couple of bucks. That's not wow. stopping them. You think they don't know how to get around region coding?
Maybe I just need to find a 13-year-old Chinese boy.
That's what you need. That's all you need. Yeah, anti-piracy measures kind of bug me because they really they don't stop bad guys. They stop good guys. And they turn – the sad thing is you're now going to learn how to get around it. They're going to – you're going to find out because it's easily discovered on the internet how to get around it. So it turns good guys into bad guys. Now you have the skills with a Z. Right?
Put myself up on Craigslist.
You could – yeah. Yeah. So there's got to be a better way. I actually don't mind the movies, you know, movie companies running ads saying, please don't steal. Right. That's fine. Do that. Try to use social methods. But technical methods fail invariably. Invariably. They just don't work. Hey, I appreciate the call. Thank you. Enjoy that. Enjoy that Phantom of the Opera. It sounds like fun. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I was going to give the phone number, but I'm actually not here. I'm a ghost. So, but we do have more calls coming up right after this. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. And that's the number that Bill in Huntsville, Alabama called. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Fine. I'm a fan from the tech TV days.
Well, thank you. That was a way ago, more than 20 years ago now, when we started. Yeah.
About the time I retired.
I'm not stopping. I like doing this. As long as you listen, I'll keep doing it.
Okay. Well, I'm doing a new computer build.
You are a good old-timer. Building your own, huh? Nice.
Yeah. Using the leaderboard on Ryan Trout's site.
I highly recommend that, PCPER.com, because they do the testing of all the hardware, and then they put together, they call it their hardware leaderboard. It's right there at the top of the page. Four different machines based on price point. You've got your low-end, your mid-range, your high-end, and then your dream system. Which one are you building?
The high-end.
Oh, nice. Nice. So that's an AMD Ryzen they recommend. That's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, my problem is a few months ago, I decided to get back into trying to relearn my electronics and programming skills, and I got into the Arduino.
Oh, how fun.
Well, the problem is I spent a lot of time building up sketches and libraries, and when I moved, just installing ordinary programs, no big deal. But I spent a lot of time building those, and I like to export them all over to the new machine. And I don't know how to do that.
They're stored on what?
They're stored on the old, on a Windows machine.
Oh, I see. So they are on your old machine. They're not like, okay. And you just,
correct.
Yeah. Does the old machine still work?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, the simplest thing would be just to get a USB key, copy it onto that, and then put it in the new machine. But, you know, here's another thought since you're building it. You could take the hard drive out of the old machine and make it be a second or third hard drive in the new machine, and then everything would be there.
Well, the thing is, what I did was I tested it on a laptop today. I did what you said. I copied the folders from my C drive in the X86, the program X86 folder for Arduino, and I copied in under my username the app data local, and then there's another Arduino folder. I first did an install on the laptop, and then I copied all that stuff over, and I thought, well, it should see all that stuff like it did on the old machine.
Yeah.
I opened it up, and it's like I'm starting all over again. It doesn't see everything, even though they're there.
Oh, well, I don't know if they're there then. Maybe they didn't copy like you thought they did.
But I just want, is that...
Those files should be visible. I mean, it's Windows. It should be just as visible. Sometimes, yeah, I thought you might be going, sometimes if you have a new login, files will be locked. They'll say, well, you don't own these, and you can take ownership of them as long as you're an administrator account using the security tab in the file properties, you can actually take control of somebody, you know, files owned by other people. It'll say owner, and then there's a button that says change next to it. It's the old style control panel. But it doesn't sound like you can't even see them. You can't even look at them.
Well, yeah, I can see them in the file manager.
Oh, you can see them, but you can't open them.
But when I run the app, and I thought, well, I should, if I looked at the recent files that I opened, I should be able to see what my most recent sketch was on my old machine and all the libraries and everything, and they don't show up. It looks like I'm going to have to go through and reinstall everything.
No. They're there. You may not have copied them. They may not have been in the folder you thought, but if you saw them and you can see them in Explorer, you just can't see them in the Arduino interface. It may be that you don't own them, and that's easy enough to fix. You have to do that in the file properties. There's no reason why they, if you can see them in Explorer, there's no reason why they wouldn't be there. What app are you trying to open them with?
Oh, I'm just trying to open them with the Arduino IDE.
Okay. So the IDE, you open it up, you're looking at that folder, and it doesn't see those files. But File Explorer does.
Right.
And you got the extensions and all that correct, right? You didn't change the file names or change the extensions.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, the IDE should see it. It may be a permissions issue, because remember, the permissions on that file, they were owned by your old account, not your new account. So it could be that. But again, that's look, here's what I would do. Go back into File Explorer. You see those files. They're where you expect them. They're in the folders you want them to be in, right?
Right.
Right. So right-click one of the files, select Properties. Look at those properties. See if everything looks normal. If for instance, go in the security tab, they'll be owned by your old account. You want to make sure them owned by your current account. But also make sure that you're allowed to modify them, to read them. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with file permissions, but on modern operating systems, there are file permissions. Not only who owns it, but whether you can read it, whether you can execute it, whether you can write to it, what kinds of permissions. It could be the permissions somehow got corrupted when you moved them over. You'd still see them. They'd still be physically there. You'd see them in File Explorer, but the IDE wouldn't open them because it said, well, I don't have read permission, for instance. So that's where you want to look. You want to look in the advanced properties right-click on one of those files that you can't see in the Arduino IDE, but you can see in the folder. Right-click on it, select properties, and then look around. Make sure you have read access, for instance. And you might click the advanced tab and then take a look at who owns it, and then you can change the owner to you, stuff like that.
Okay.
All right. I have a feeling. Now, somebody in the chat room is saying if the IDE is like Eclipse, it might even be Eclipse, which is an open source IDE. If you didn't get the .projects folder, the projects won't have come over, so you wouldn't see them in the projects listing. So this is an issue with the IDE. The IDE doesn't look at the directory the same way the Explorer does. It looks at the projects folder to see what files are in the projects. So that's another issue. You may not have gotten there's a hidden folder, .projects. You may not have gotten that. Make sure you get all the folders, including the ., the ones that begin with .. .dot folders are not visible.
Okay, I'll look at those.
Yeah, I bet you that's, you know what? That was somebody in the chat room suggested that, and I bet you that's exactly what it is. That the IDE isn't looking at what's on the hard drive. It's looking at the projects folder.
I was hoping to get it resolved before I started the new build.
Yeah, you're smart because you want to make sure you got it. Assert zero, thank you. I think you're exactly right. The IDE is not looking in the same way as, you know, File Explorer is looking. What's on the hard drive? That's what's on the hard drive. That's not how the IDE works. It gets a list of files in the project from the projects folder. If it is Eclipse, it's .projects, but other make sure you get all of the stuff, even the hidden files, from the original computer. I bet you that's what it is. Good catch, assert zero. See, we got a good team here. They're working hard. Let's get some more calls in just a bit. Johnny Jett coming up, our travel guru, right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Look who's here. Flying in from gosh knows where. Mr. Johnny Jett. Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Leo. It's nice to see you again.
My personal travel guru, Johnny, travels the world and helps us each week travel better with technology. It's real. We were talking last week about how much the smartphone has really changed how we travel, hasn't it?
Big time.
Yeah.
I mean, from especially for getting cars. I mean, Ubers and Lyfts, they really, you know, especially the language barrier. First of all, they dropped the prices by 40%. But, you know, when I was in France recently and you're trying to get a car, and I do not speak French, and the drivers usually don't speak English, you know, you just put in where you're going.
Ici.
And you don't need to say a word to each other.
Là. Go yeah. there. No, so, it's great. In fact, that's the first place I used Uber was in Paris. They had just launched in Paris. This was 2012, I think. And actually, it was a little dodgy then. We got about halfway, and the driver goes, "Oh, zut! The application crashed."
Oh, my God.
So he didn't know what to charge us. I think it was phony. But, you know, phony baloney. But anyway, it was a good experience, or it has been a good experience since then. But I don't even – not just Uber. I mean, maps – translators?
I mean, translation, for sure. I mean, it's huge. Everything like that. I mean, these days, there's no excuse. Before, you know, my friends could say, you know, I don't travel internationally because I don't speak the language. I mean, I barely speak English. So, I was like, that's not a good excuse. But
no, that's the really reason to go. That's the reason to go. Get a new experience. I'm thinking about this because I'm about to go on vacation. This is my entertainment device. So I use audiobooks from Audible, and I'm downloading them like crazy. I just downloaded a 27-hour book. So I'll have that to listen to on the plane. Because, man, I mean, the worst thing in the world is to get on the plane and forget your headphones and you know, have to watch the movie or listen to the baby cry. I love having an audiobook. I put music on here, too, same reason. The entertainment, and actually I use the Kindle app on my iPad for reading. I don't carry books or magazines with me anymore. I have Texture and Kindle on my app, on my iPad, and that way I've got all the reading material. I mean, that really is everything. That's saved a lot of time and space.
Before my wife and I went on our honeymoon, that morning of our flight, we were in Toronto, and we were flying to South Korea and then to Bali. Her electronic e-reader crashed.
Yikes.
She literally had a panic attack. She's like, I cannot get on a 13-hour flight without my books. So we had to run to the store on the way to the airport to buy a new one.
Wow. Instead of buying some books, you bought another e-reader.
For sure. Yeah. She was a big time. Reads a book a week. I don't know how she does it. I barely read a book a year. And she reads them on the planes. She's just reading or now watching Jack, our son, but you know, she'd always read.
Is she a Kindle user? Is that what she uses?
Now she is, but before that was a Kobo.
Yeah, wow.
Which is Canadian.
Yeah.
And which was sold, I think, to a Japanese company.
Yeah, Rakuten.
Right. So she was a huge Kobo reader user, and now she's the Amazon.
Yeah, you know what's nice about Kindle is I don't have to carry a separate Kindle. I just put it on the app on my iPad, and now I have all my books.
Yeah, I'm not sure if she does it, actually. She must, but
it's not as easy on the eyes. You know, it's glowing instead of being that e-ink stuff.
Yeah.
And anyway, the hugest change for me is that I can now read even on my iPad while the plane's taking off. I don't have to sit there staring into space, listening to the clunking and clattering of things that I don't know what that means. And getting all nervous, I just read a book. I bet she does the same thing.
Without a doubt. Yep. And not only has it been the technology for the, you know, our phones and computers, but the connectivity. So, you know, in-flight Wi-Fi is huge for me because I can do my work on the plane. And then when we land, you know, I use T-Mobile, which I still think is the best in terms of Wi-Fi around the world. I think they're in 150 countries.
I just paid, and I think this is a new feature. If you pay an extra $25 a month, you don't. You know how T-Mobile gives you free data around most of the world, but it's slow.
2G, yeah.
It's 2G. If you pay an extra $25 a month, I think you get full LTE.
Well, that's well worth it.
Yeah. I'll give you feedback when I get back. And I also carry that orange hockey puck that I really like. what is it called? I can never remember the name of this thing. It's a Wi-Fi access point. You pay $9 a day or $99 a month. So we're going to be gone 3 weeks. So $99 gives me plenty of bandwidth, unlimited high-speed bandwidth almost everywhere. You know where it doesn't work? Where Google Fi doesn't work, and I bet T-Mobile doesn't work? Monaco.
No, I've never had problems in Monaco.
Maybe it was just Google Fi. It said, no, we don't work in Monaco. But, you know, you're literally half a mile from France. So.
Yeah, well, actually, my wife and I were in Monaco a few years ago, and we had breakfast in Monaco, we had lunch in Italy, and dinner in France.
Yeah, and you could have walked.
Yes.
All right. I don't want to use up
the train to Italy.
I don't want to use up your whole segment. What do you got for us this week?
All right. So, actually, since we're talking about travel, here is the one I was going to mention next week. But how do you take photos on your phone? I mean, do you use your phone or do you bring your big camera?
Well, I do both. I do both. And if I'm gonna post it on social media, a lot of times I just do it on the phone because it's easier.
Okay. Right. And have you ever heard of the app called the Slow Shutter Cam?
No.
So this is an iPhone app, and I mean, you don't need it for your Nexus and Pixel because the LG devices, they already have it built in. But for iPhones, you need this because it will help you merge shorter exposures so into a single image. So you can take that professional looking photo, especially in dark places, or if you want, if you're taking a picture of a freeway. Exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
So it's called the Slow Shutter Cam, but you don't only need it. It's only for iPhone because you don't need it for the other devices. And it's $1.99. But it's been around for a while, but it did win the best app ever award.
Wow.
A few years ago. So I was wondering, it does the motion blur. It does the light trail. It's great in low light conditions.
That's neat. Slow Shutter Cam from Cogitap, $1.99 on the iOS App Store.
And that way you don't have to bring your big DSL around if you just carry an iPhone. I mean, I have the iPhone 10, and that takes incredible photos. So now what I do is I travel with that, and then if I bring my big camera, I just have a zoom on that one. That way I can get both.
I have a good friend who's a professional photographer, really talented, who just went to Bhutan, the happiest country in the world. And he's a professional. He used to carry lots of gear with him. He said, I didn't even bring my camera. I just brought my iPhone.
Wow.
And
iPhone 10?
Yeah. And he said, I think he has an iPhone 8. He said it was easy, happy, everything I needed. He's got beautiful pictures. That is another way, isn't it, that the smartphone has changed how we travel.
So which one do you think is better, this iPhone 10 or 8 for photos?
I think they're exactly the same, actually. The same
camera.
Well,
actually, but the 8 doesn't have the portrait mode in selfie mode, which the 10 does.
No, it's got different front cameras, but the back cameras, which are the ones you're going to mostly use. Well, maybe you take a lot of selfies when you
travel? Well, I take a lot of selfies when I travel.
The iPhone 10 is much better selfie cam. You're right.
For sure, because you can take a nice portrait.
But the back camera is the same.
Okay.
So, but that's a good point. Selfie, there's nothing like the iPhone 10 for selfies. And you could do those memojis and the animojis, the talking lion. All right, I've used up all your time.
That's right. I got more for next week.
Next week. Johnny Jett, he's our traveling guy. You could follow him on his actually, the best place to go is his website, johnnyjett.com. You can sign up for his free travel newsletters. You can read all his great articles, look at his images, find out more about his beautiful boy, his baby boy, Jack. His wife, Natalie. You can also follow him on Twitter and Instagram. And he's here every week. Thank you, Johnny. Safe travels.
Thank you. You too.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We go back to the telephones. And right now on line 4 from Compton, California, Leonard. Hey, Leonard.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I'm actually computer illiterate, and I was thinking about buying a laptop and trying to get. I'm looking for a laptop that would, they have very low vision, and I was trying to get a recommendation from you.
What is your goal? What would you like to do with a computer? Why are you getting one?
Well, I just want to go on the internet and have them read me the websites and certain things that I look for projects, and maybe
I love that.
Do some dictation on it to, you know, send out letters.
It's a very powerful, we call it accessibility tool, that can be used, and so many people with various disabilities use this in so many great ways. You said low vision. You have some vision?
Only light vision, only light perception.
Okay.
I cannot read the screen.
So that's an issue, because you're going to need something called a screen reader in order to use it. And this is the good news, is that there's a lot of attention has been paid to accessibility, particularly for blind users, so that they can use a computer. But it generally takes some additional help, because you're going to you can't just learn it yourself. You're going to need somebody to show you how to use it. There's a commercial program called JAWS that a lot of people use. It's really expensive. It's actually more expensive than the computer. But you can often get some support from a local disabilities resource center or Lighthouse for the Blind. Do you use anybody? Do you have any resources or services that you use now?
No.
All right. No. So that's the first thing to do is find somebody who can give you a hand getting this computer and setting it up and teaching you how to use it. Because it will be, you're absolutely right, it will be a boon. But it's not something, if you can't see at all, that you're going to be able to even figure out, because you're not going to know what, you know, you need somebody to say, okay, here's what you do. Feel this key. Okay, you're going to tap that three times, and then VoiceOver will launch. And then feel these keys. Those are the arrow keys. You tap those arrow keys to move over different parts of the screen. Make sure the speaker's on, and now you can hear him tell you. Now, when you hear this, and you've never used a computer before?
No.
Yeah, so this is not going to be something you can do by yourself. You're going to need some assistance, because somebody's going to have to show you how. You understand what I'm saying. Somebody's going to have to show you how to do this. The other thing is, really, you want to get some financial assistance, because, unfortunately, the companies that make these products just charge through the nose. It's not right. But they know that there's state disability resources and insurers, and there's plenty of people who will pay for it. So we're going to charge you an arm and a leg. But it's not something somebody on disability is going to want to pay for themselves. So I would person I call is Lighthouse for the Blind. I'm not sure what's around in your area. You might call and see if you can get some help from a state disabilities coordinator. Are you on disability?
Yes.
Yeah. So you have somebody that you're in touch with, I'm sure, about that. Ask them. Okay, this is what I want to do. I want to get a computer. I think this is brilliant. I know so many blind people who are very effective using computers, and it empowers you. It makes it makes you a member of the community. You're back in the world. It'll read your email to you. You can write email by dictating it. Suddenly, the world is out there, and you can use it, but you're going to have to get some training up front. So you've got to find somebody who will support you in doing this. I know Lighthouse of the Blind does some great stuff, but I don't know what the resources are in your community. So that's where you're going to have to do some research.
No, I know. I've contacted them before on some other issues.
Good. So, there's also Computers for the Blind. Somebody in the chat room is telling me computersfortheblind.org. Let me see if I can find a phone number for you, because even if it's not the exact right person, they'll help you find the right person. Computers for the Blind is a nonprofit volunteer organization that helps blind people get computers. So let me give you their number. You ready?
Yes.
Yeah, 214-340-6328. Now, they're in the 214 area code, so that means they're not in your area, but they're going to, you know, this is what they do. They're going to be able to help you find somebody in your area that can make a difference. They're in the Dallas area.
Okay.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm glad I could help. And then call me in a few months when you're doing this. I think you're going to see. I'm so glad you want to do this. Don't give up.
No.
Don't give up. It's going to be hard at first, but you know that, right? Are you blind from birth, or is this a new condition?
New condition.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
But you know, if it was easy, everybody would do it.
You got a sense of humor. I like that. Yeah, hang in there. I know this has been a challenge probably in many, many ways. This is one more. But I think it's really important. I see so many people with a whole variety of disabilities. Look at Stephen Hawking, who was so disabled he couldn't speak, he couldn't move, but he was set up with a computer that gave him speech. He gave speeches, he talked, and for years he was able to write. One of our greatest physicists, one of our greatest minds, and was completely disabled, and was able, thanks to computers, to participate, to create new works, to talk to people. And that can be the same for you. So, yeah, get some help. Find somebody who will help you and get you set up. And I bet you we'll talk again in a few months and you'll have some good news. I hope so. That's really great. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're talking high tech, talking about computers, talking about the way the world is. Now, I'm going to make a confession to you right now. I am not here. I am right now. I'm in Barcelona, Spain. We recorded this a little bit ahead of time, and I realized I did a very dumb thing. I planned a vacation the exact week Apple announces new phones. What was I thinking? So, for all I know, they've already announced the date. If they haven't, they will soon. This is the time of year when Apple puts out its new phones. Of course, the good news is I know as little right now about Apple's new phone as I will on September 1st, because Apple is very good at keeping great secrets. So we will. The good news is that I will not be here for a couple of weeks, but Rich DeMuro from KTLA is coming in. Yay, Rich. We love Rich. And he'll be here on September 15th, 16th, 22nd, and 23rd, the last four shows of the month. And he will have been at the Apple event. He will know everything there is to know, and he'll be able to answer your questions about the iPhone. So don't ask me now. I don't know anything. Maybe next week we'll know a little bit more. I would typically, these events are something like the Wednesday after Labor Day. So if the invitations haven't gone out yet, and of course, one of the reasons I can be out of the country is Apple never invites me. I don't have to worry about that. But I would like to. I will be ordering this phone the minute they announce it, and I'll get it for you. And we will have, of course, a review unit, and we can talk a little bit about it. Be interesting. I can speculate a little bit. I suspect Apple is going to make a bigger phone. One of the complaints on the iPhone X, and I do think the iPhone X, last year's top of the line iPhone, will be the model for whatever they announce this month. But I do think it'll be a little bit bigger, because if there is one complaint about the iPhone X, it's not as big as the 8 Plus. It's a little bigger than the 8, but not as big as the 8 Plus. And I think people do want slightly bigger phone. I actually like the size of the iPhone X, but expect a larger phone. We'll still, I'm sure, have Face ID, the new user interface, and finally, the release of iOS 12. And when that happens, yeah, we'll talk about it. Let's take a break. News coming up at the top of the hour. More of your calls to Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Tech Guy Podcast is brought to you today by Rocket Mortgage, the best lender in the country. Quicken Loans, very customer-centric, number one in customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power, for 8 years in a row now. Every year they win it. And they want to make it easier for you to buy your new home. They want to take the anxiety out of it. There is anxiety, right? It's the biggest check you'll ever write. This is a place you and your family are going to live for a long time. You want to pick the right house, the perfect house. So why be rushed because you're worried about interest rates going up? Why have the anxiety? Can we get the money? Go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. You sign up. It takes just a minute to fill out the form. No visit to the bank. No 20-page application. No visits to the attic or calls. I need my pay stubs from 2008. None of that. They do it all for you. You just go in there, fill out the simple application form, answer a few questions. They will go to their trusted relationships and all the financial institutions, get what they need. Then a loan officer looks at it. In 24 hours or less, they will give you what they call verified approval. They verify your income, your assets, and your credit. Once you get verified approval and you get that verified approval letter, you can show that to a realtor. You have the strength of a cash buyer. A seller looks at that and goes, oh, I don't have to worry. They're good for it. They've got the loan. That's when step three of the power buying process kicks in. And I love this. This really takes the anxiety out. Rate Shield approval. They lock the rate. That rate you got, that's guaranteed for up to 90 days. You have up to 3 months to shop for a house with no pressure, no matter what happens to interest rates. And they have been ticking up, haven't they? Yours won't go up. Yours will, it could go down. If it goes down, it'll go down. They will lower it. They will not raise it. It's a guaranteed rate for the next 90 days. What? That's so cool. The power buying process and Quicken Loans' new exclusive Rate Shield approval. It's the kind of thinking to expect from America's number one lender. Number one for good reason. Here's all you do. Just go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Rate Shield approval is valid only on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. Do us a favor. It's good for the Tech Guy podcast. Keeps us going. Pays for the lights, the staff. Pays for me. But it pays off for you, too. It is, if you're going to get a new home, please do me a favor. Go to RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. Now on with the show. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, the show where we talk about computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches. I'm going to go back to the phones in just a second, but the next few weeks, we're going to do something a little different. A friend of mine has written a book. Adam Fisher is his name. The book is called Valley of Genius, The Uncensored History of Silicon Valley. It includes interviews with over 200 of the most important people who made Silicon Valley what it is today. And I thought it might be fun for you to hear some of these people's voices. So over the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk to people like Steve Wozniak, Nolan Bushnell, Sean Parker, and a name you might not know, Scott Hassan, who was the third founder of Google and gets no credit for it. Let's start with Steve Wozniak. Adam Fisher, tell me about Woz.
Yeah, he is the epitome of hacker. Basically, he was Stephen Levy's inside source when he wrote the book Hackers.
No kidding. I didn't know that. Because it's not about Woz. It's about the MIT hackers and Richard Stallman and people like that.
Yeah,
but Woz knew all about it.
Yeah. The book came out right before the Macintosh was released, so I don't think Levy really understood the importance of Woz at that time. But yeah, he was whispering in Levy's ear the whole time.
Tell me, set the scene. Where did you talk to Woz?
So I emailed Woz, and he wanted to meet at the Hickory Pit Barbecue.
He loves that place.
Yeah, it's like
down in San Jose.
It's a diner.
He eats there all the time.
All the time.
In fact, I know because I follow him on Foursquare, and he checks in there like every day. So did you?
Yeah. We had breakfast, and when you hear these clips, you'll hear the clattering of coffee cups, and he really opened up to me.
Steve didn't even want to start a computer company when we started Apple. I don't know if you ever got that out.
I didn't know that.
No. First of all, people like think, oh, Steve was into computers, what they would do for people someday was his whole life. Never talked like that. I was at the Homebrew Computer Club. Steve never attended. He'd never been there. He was up in Oregon. I had built a computer. I had given it away for free to everybody at the club. I had helped others build it. I was a hero at the club. Steve came into town. I said, you got to come down and see this.
Jobs got a job at Atari.
That's right. Woz was at HP. Jobs dropped out of Reed, got a job at Atari. The ad was, you know, have fun, make money.
Steve liked that second part.
Steve was employee number 19.
Wow.
And Woz, and he was just basically a tech. He was soldering up circuit boards and causing trouble, actually. And he got switched over to the night, like he was a night tech, so that his supervisor didn't have to deal with him.
Or smell him. His personal hygiene was notoriously bad. He thought because he had a vegan diet that he didn't have body odor.
He was a fruitarian at the time.
Not even vegan, just fruit.
And he would unlock the kind of factory floor at night and let Woz in, because Woz was obsessed with this early Atari game called Grand Trek 10, I think. Maybe 20. It was a driving game.
I saw it in an arcade. I did a copy of Pong in 28 chips, and two of the chips put a four-letter word on when you missed the ball. So I'm into humor. And I showed it to my friends at Hewlett-Packard all the time. And then Steve came into town. and he saw it. And he took my board down to Atari, and he got a job there. And I don't know if he was telling them that he had designed it, or he and another guy had designed it, or what. But I'm sure they were impressed by it, because they considered he was trying to talk them into using it for their first home Pong game, sell it to people in the home. And they made the right decision.
So Jobs comes to Woz and says, "You want to make a little money?"
Yes. And this is not the first time that that was said. Before that was, of course, the Blue Box, phone freaking thing. And this was his next one. Yeah, make a little money.
Well, Breakout was hardware. Okay. I could tell the story. Steve came to me and said, "Nolan Bushnell wants a game. Here's how it works. Can you do it?" "Oh, I would love to do it." "Can you do it in 4 days?" "Nobody can do it in 4 days. This is a half a man year, months of prototyping work." And I was the hottest designer in the world. I did not think I could do it. And I said, "I'll try." And I stayed up 4 days and nights and did it. What happened was, Steve said, if it's under 50, he asked me how many chips my design was at first. And I said, "It looks like 45 chips. And he said, "I realize it was a management technique." I smile at it now. It was really good. But he said, "Yes, if we get it under 50 chips, we get $700. But if we get it under 40 chips, we get $1,000. He was motivating me to get it down. I got it down as low as 42. But by the time we finished, it was back up to 45. And Steve may have even added a sound chip after I left the last morning to make it 46 or something. But, so he wrote me a personal check for $350, half of the $700. And it was, I think, 12 years later. I brought Andy and Bill Atkinson and Burl Smith. I think that was all of them. Then Andy on the plane came and he said, "Yeah, he'd read this book about Atari." I said, "Oh, it probably says how I did Breakout." He says, "Yeah, that was in there." I was proud. And I said, "Yeah, we got paid $700. And he says, "It said you got paid thousands." And then he brought the book over to me. I was crying. I'm almost crying now. Because, you know what? I'm the sort of person that anyone who knows me, Steve could have come to me and said, "I need all the money to buy into a commune up in Oregon. Can I keep all the money?" I would have said, "Yes, absolutely. I have a job as an engineer."
So that you, Adam, actually got Woz to say something that he has been unwilling to say for decades, which is, that for a long time he said, "Oh no, Steve didn't get paid more than he said." And finally, he admitted that Jobs kind of ripped off his buddy. I never had heard him say that.
And Woz, you talk to him, and over the years he's been asked about this, and he says, "Oh, friendship is more important than money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." But I think now that Jobs has died, the truth has come out, and he really unloaded.
Here's a visit with Woz and the early days of Apple. We take you back to, what is it called, the Hickory Wagon?
The Hickory Pit.
The Hickory Pit.
Okay, in the garage, we never talked about what a product could be, what we might build. We never did any engineering design in the garage, any drafting. We never did any prototyping of building early machines, the first machines. We never did any manufacturing in the garage. Steve did the business in his bedroom. He'd get on the phone and order parts and sales, and eventually got a super long line he could drag out to the garage. We only needed the garage for about a couple of hours a week. Almost never were any people in the garage, very few, one or two just sitting there for fun, but nothing to do. Once a week, we'd drive down and pick up the computers were manufactured somewhere else in Santa Clara. We'd pick them up and drive maybe 20 of them to the garage. And then we'd plug each of the 20 in IKEA style to keyboards and all, make sure they worked, put them in white boxes, and then Steve would drive the white boxes to the bike store where Paul Terrell would pay cash, because we had no money. So that's one thing Steve was good at. Use whatever you can, So we would get the parts on credit. We'd owe a lot of money in 30 days, but we'd get paid cash at the store. So the garage was really, you think there, oh, we had desks and a bunch of people were there and we had the things that companies have. No, it was just a house. Because when you have no money, you start in your house. So the garage represents our humility.
Thank you, Adam Fisher. ValleyofGenius.com/Twit if you want to get a copy of the book. Let's take a little time out. We'll go back to the phones in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones. We go on line one, Lloyd in Billings, Montana. Hello, Lloyd.
How are you, Leo?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for calling.
Great. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed the talk about you were dropping Facebook last week.
Yeah. You know, I come and go. So initially I deleted my account, and Facebook lets you do that. But right. After I did it, I missed a very wonderful, almost missed a wonderful reunion planned by coworkers from 20 years back. And I thought, this is a problem. So I reactivated it. And then I thought, but I don't want to have. So now what I do is I deactivate it, which keeps the account around. You can't use it. You can't add to it. You can't see any messages. It's no, you know, it's just it's there. But if you ever want to reactivate it, you just log in and it's reactivated. So periodically I'll log in, see if I've missed anything, and then I'll deactivate it again. And I find this, for me anyway, a very good way to use Facebook.
Right.
Are you a Facebook user?
In about the last year, a little bit, like you, I just found a lot of irritation.
I found like I didn't feel good after I looked at it.
All right.
So I decided it wasn't a good thing for me. I can, you know, for a lot of people, that's how they stay in touch. My kids, that's how they stay in touch with their classmates from college and high school. And I think that's fine. I just found it wasn't for me. And so I'm not recommending it or anything. I'm just saying this is what works for me.
Yep. Gotcha.
Yep.
Gotcha. I'm having trouble with my email. The computer died about a month and a half ago, and my computer guy set me up with a new setup here. And since then, the email's not working properly. I open it, and emails delete that I'm not deleting. And
open it, and you see – now, first of all, I got to understand how you do your email. So it used to be, and you probably remember these days, you'd run an email program, Outlook Live, Microsoft Live Mail, Thunderbird. You'd have an email program which you'd open. It would download your email and you'd read it, and it would send email for you if you sent it. Nowadays, most people just open a web browser, Internet Explorer, Edge, Safari, Chrome, and use that for their email. So which is it for you? Are you using a browser or a dedicated email program?
Well, I've got Microsoft Outlook.
Okay.
It's a Gmail account.
So you could do it with the browser, but you're having Outlook go out to Gmail and get the mail.
Right.
Yeah.
I do believe.
Okay.
And I've got a ton of emails here that from Gmail. There's like 45,000 of them.
Yeah, that's one of the things we love about Gmail. It's really the selling point was you don't have to delete your mail. They'll store it all.
Sure.
In the old days, you'd launch Outlook or Thunderbird or Outlook Express or whatever. It would download the mail and then delete it on the server because internet service providers didn't want to waste space storing your mail. So they'd let you download it and then you'd delete it. But that's not how Gmail works. In fact, that's why Gmail, when it came out about 15 years ago, was huge. You don't have to delete it. You just keep it there and you can search it and it's always available to you.
Sure.
A lot of people, that's become our address book, our to-do list, our memory. I can search back through my email. I can remember the name of that plumber I used 4 years ago, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
You opened Outlook, and can you see the email disappear before your very eyes?
If I just, I'll click on a email, and it'll delete it. It may go about. And three more, it'll delete. And then I'll hit the delete button on the computer keyboard if there's one I want to delete. And it'll go ahead and delete that. And let's say if I have 10 or 20 I want to delete, I hold the delete button down and I get a notice up that says operation failed because of a registry or installation problem. Restart out.
Oh, boy.
Try again.
So the guy who fixed your computer, what was he fixing?
My other computer just flat died,
So he got you a new computer and moved everything over from the old one.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's an imperfect process, as you're discovering. And somehow he didn't move it around over correctly. I think there's a couple of things to do. First of all, launch a browser and go to gmail.com. You'll have to log into your Google account. And look there and see if the stuff that's been disappearing is there.
Okay.
I bet it is. Gmail is really, they intend for you to use their Google Chrome's browser to look at it. They want you to use the browser to get Gmail, but you don't have to.
Sure.
The next step, once you've done that and verified that Gmail's working properly, which I'm sure it is to, I would suggest, reconfigure Outlook to work with Gmail properly. And that is an easy enough thing to do. You're going to go into Outlook in the Outlook settings under accounts and delete Gmail from the account. Don't worry, this doesn't delete any mail. Gmail keeps the mail on its server. So by deleting the account, you're merely deleting the settings that allow Outlook to go get Gmail. You can then go on to Gmail's help section. You can even Google it. How do I set up Outlook and Gmail? And there will be page after page of instructions that will be fairly easy to follow, just like a cookbook, for configuring Outlook to work properly. I think it's not, there's something wrong with Outlook. And it probably has to do with the fact that the guy who did the transfer didn't, in fact, set everything up fresh. He just copied. And probably something didn't get copied for him.
Okay.
So I would just start over, basically. The first thing to do is to go to gmail.com in the browser and look at it and make sure it's behaving as you expect. I'm sure it is, but, you know, let's make sure that all the mail's there, that you read the mail. In fact, you may say to yourself, why am I using Outlook? This works fine. It's really intended to work fine. It was the very first web app, and it really is designed in a browser to work as if you were using Outlook. It has a compose box. All the features are there. All the settings are there. If you want to change your Gmail account, you pretty much have to go to that page anyway. So I would first see how you like it. You might not need Outlook at all. And if you say, no, I like Outlook, I want to use Outlook, then I would go into the Outlook settings, remove the Gmail account, and then recreate it. And they'll, you know, basically the settings are, as with all email clients, you have to tell it the servers to visit imap.gmail.com, I think it is, but I would check what ports to use, what behaviors, you know, when I delete mail on my Outlook account, do I want to delete it from Gmail? You can set it that way. I wouldn't. The whole premise of Gmail is that you never have to erase mail. And why should you? You can delete it from Outlook, but you don't have to delete it from Gmail so that it's always there. It sounds like you're doing that since you've got thousands of messages. Gmail, I think, is a great boon, but it really is intended to, you know, think about it. Google wants you to use Chrome. They want you to use their browser. They would prefer it that way. iPad 67624 is telling me might also want, in our chat room, Repair Outlook is under Programs and Features in the control panel. Maybe Repair Outlook, maybe that'll fix it too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on we go. And line two is Risa. I think it's Risa in Riverside. Is that how you say it?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Risa.
Hi. I am calling regarding a question with my iCloud account.
Okay.
I started the iCloud account on my iPhone with the normal settings. I upgraded to the 99-cent a month plan. I recently, last week, upgraded on my computer, on my Mac computer, to the 2-terabyte plan.
Yeah, I had to do that, too. Apple really, I'm not completely comfortable with the way Apple does this, because they keep reminding you, oh, you know, you really ought to be backing up on iCloud. And when you first set up a Mac, you probably went right through it, but there's a checkbox that says store your documents in desktop on iCloud. That's by default checked. They have all sorts of ways to get you to use more iCloud, which, oh, you pay for. Now you know how Apple made $9.2 billion in services last quarter.
Yeah. I did that, but now my iPhone wants me to upgrade my iPhone plan.
Uh-oh.
I thought they were the same.
They are the same.
Yeah, and I use the same
Apple ID. The same Apple account in both of them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would go to the apps, the settings on your iPhone, and go to the iCloud section and make sure you're logged in under exactly the same iCloud email address.
I am.
Well, it should know that you have the 2-terabyte plan.
That's what I thought, right.
Wait a minute. Let me look at this here. That's a little puzzling. I'm going to open up my iPhone here real quickly and see, because that's not how it's supposed to behave. You have one iCloud account. If you've upgraded it anywhere on the iPhone or the Mac or the iPad for that matter, it should be upgraded everywhere.
Yeah, it's still showing me on my phone. It shows the 50 gigabyte.
Oh,
my Mac it shows my 2 terabyte.
No, that's wrong. Make sure you type the email exactly the same. You know what? Here's what I would do on the phone. Log out. You'll see right underneath the account, there's a log out button, and re-log in.
Okay.
Because if it's the same account, there's no reason in the world it shouldn't see the same amount of storage on both. That's how it works. Now, maybe it got confused, so by logging out of iCloud and logging back in, you'll... Oh, gee, you have 2 terabytes. maybe that's what happened, but yeah, that's weird. That's not, no, and I should reassure you, that's how I have the 2 terabyte plan too, and that's how it works for me.
That's what I want in order to back up all of my pictures.
Right. But, now, can I suggest you have options. iCloud is the easiest thing in the world because it's an Apple product and they make it easy for you and you don't have to really think about it. But there are things like pictures that will really jam it up. It's easy to get more than 2 gigabytes of pictures.
Yeah.
Be hard to get more than 2 terabytes, but who knows?
Yeah.
So one of the advantages of iCloud is you can turn on iCloud Photo Library and photos on the desktop and on the phone. Then they'll have the same photos. The originals are preserved, protected up on iCloud, but they can be thumbnails on the phone that are just right for the size of the screen there. They can be thumbnails on the Mac that are just right for the size of the screen there. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. But it is expensive. Apple charges more for iCloud storage than comparable plans. And
okay.
What I would suggest regardless is get Google Photos. Now, unless you hate Google, and some people are just paranoid about Google, Google Photos is a great deal. They will give you unlimited storage of your photos from anywhere, including your phone.
Okay.
They say it's not original quality, so it's not. So if you want to keep the originals, are you using your iPhone to take the pictures or another camera?
My iPhone.
So, truthfully, the photos will be as good on Google Photos as the originals. If you were using a super-duper Blasto 5000 Canon photo lens thingamajig,
no.
Then maybe you'd want to keep the originals, too. But honestly, the Google Photos does not change the quality of the picture perceptibly.
Okay.
And it has unlimited storage, and it has another really nice feature, which I like. In the app, it'll automatically – you do have to open the app once in a while to automatically back up your photos, but then there's a button that says delete photos that are backed up, so you can actually save space on your phone by doing it that way and eliminate iCloud entirely. I think it's fine to have both. I actually do both, and that way I get all the benefits of iCloud, but I'm not relying on iCloud. If something goes wrong, I still have the backup on Google.
Okay, that's good. I will do that.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. How much is it for 2 terabytes? Is it $2 a month? $5 a month?
2 terabytes is $10 a month.
$10 a month.
Yeah.
So that's actually not that bad. That's a lot of storage. You have more storage than you'll ever need, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, I will try that. Thank you.
I really appreciate the call. Thank you, Risa. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's not. I mean, Google charges that for 1 terabyte, right? But by the way, Microsoft says that a terabyte's effectively unlimited. They call that unlimited. Because it's pretty hard to use that much storage. I mean, think about it. I remember when we first got PCs with 2 gigabytes of a 2 gigabyte hard drive, and people's minds were blown. I have 2,000 megabytes of storage on this hard drive? That's amazing. Of course, I'm really old. I remember buying a 5 megabyte hard drive for $5,000 and thinking that was pretty cool. But when you have 2 terabytes, that's 2,000 gigabytes. That's a lot of storage. You'd be pretty hard-pressed to fill even 1,000 gigabytes of storage up. Because it's in the cloud, it has to be uploaded. You know, it's not like you just got a hard drive there, you can copy stuff over. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's continue on to line 4 and Faye in Irvine. Hi, Faye. Hey, come to the phone.
Hello, hello. Yes, I'm here.
That's all right. That's okay. I know I've been keeping you on hold for hours. I appreciate your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you, Faye.
My problem is that I had created two profiles on Facebook a while ago, and I was able to toggle between the two on their page. And recently, just a couple months ago, one of them I can't access anymore.
Uh-oh.
Because my fault, because I was using the same password and phone number.
And so, Facebook said, you have two accounts. You only need one.
Yeah, but I had really good reason for myself.
You were using different email addresses, though, right?
Initially, I was, and I might have.
See, because you have to have some way of distinguishing. If it's the same phone number and the same password, the only other piece of data you could give them that would distinguish the two accounts would be a different email address. So you must have used two different email addresses.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and Facebook in theory doesn't want you to do this, but you know what? Lots of people do. They were both personal pages. It wasn't a business. Yeah. All right.
No, they were just both personal. Two communities that I was accessing. One was
You don't have to explain to me. There's lots of reasons that you would want to do this.
How do I contact them and get them activate the other one?
Do you think they deactivated it?
Oh, I don't know. I just heard that from you guys talking about activation, deactivation.
So what happens when you log into it? What does it say?
See, I don't get into logged in because when I put my password in, it only takes me to the one that I've been.
Yeah. So it's probably still there. So
it is, because when I put my name in there, the page does show up on my friends.
So it's not deactivated. So here's what I would suggest. Okay. The problem is the way Facebook works so that you don't have to enter your password each time is it puts a little thing called a cookie on your hard drive that says, this is Faye. She's fine. Just let her in. It's the instant login thing. The problem is that's associated with one account. If you use two browsers, download Chrome or Firefox, download a second browser, log into the second account with that browser, it will have the cookie for the second account. You'll need to use two different browsers, one for each account. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So that's the problem, is it's remembering your login to that first account. So every time you go there, it just goes, this is Faye 1. And if you wanted to, you could, by completely logging out, get to Faye 2, but you'd have to completely log out. So instead, what I would say is just, what browser do you use?
I was using Firefox.
That's fine.
For many years. Just a month ago, I stopped using that one, and I went to Chrome.
And that's when this happened, I bet.
No.
No. Okay.
No.
So you've got Chrome and Firefox. You can use both. There's nothing to keep you from doing that. And I would use a separate browser for each account. That way, you won't have to do the whole rigmarole to log in. You just open Chrome, and you'll go to Facebook, and that'll be Faye 1. You open Firefox, you go to Facebook, it'll be Faye 2.
That would be ideal, but how do I get it to do that?
Because first use that browser, it doesn't know which Faye you are. So so you log in as Faye 2.
It could just, grab the other one and log into the
It
one
doesn't look at the other the cookies from the other browser. So if you haven't installed it from scratch, it will have the old cookies still there. So you might have to go into settings and reset the browser, delete all the cookies. That way it'll be starting as if it's a fresh install.
And see which one of the two it'll take.
Log into the other one. whatever the other browser. So each browser should be different.
Yeah.
Get it?
And if it doesn't work, should I call them?
It's not Facebook. No. You know that account's there. It's what I said, which is the browser is just automatically logging into Faye 1. In order to get into Faye 2, you would have to go completely log out. Say, no, I'm not Faye 1, and do the full login to Faye 2.
Why isn't it Facebook problem?
Because it's not Facebook.
I couldn't.
No, mm-hmm. It's still there, right?
Yes, I just can't log in, but I put my name in there and it shows up, yeah.
Yeah, because it's using the cookie. Try it with a different browser, see if that works. It thinks okay. You're Faye 1.
Yeah.
Right, but you're not. You're Faye 2. So what you need to do mm-hmm. is either completely log out to where you see it says, well, who are you? It even says, would you like to sign up? What would you, the first Facebook page. Then you could mm-hmm. log in as Faye 2. But that's a pain because each time you want to change accounts, you have to completely log out of the account you're on and log in with a new one.
Yeah, if I can just get in, I'll change my password for the Faye 2.
That won't help it. That won't separate it. It's not that it's the same password. It doesn't know what your password. It doesn't care about your password. It's the browser trying to solve this problem by saying, oh, no, yeah, we're just going to log you in. So either you have to tell to start, okay. either you could, the other thing you could do is go into the browser. In the settings, you can clear cookies. Look for the Facebook cookies and delete the Facebook cookies. That would start from scratch as well. You need to start from scratch. What Facebook's trying to do is make it easy for you. So you don't have to completely log in each time. But the problem is it's remembering that you're Faye 1. You don't want to be Faye 1. You want to be Faye 2 now.
Right.
So you could, there's many ways to do it. The easiest would be to have two different browsers.
Okay.
But if you fully logged out of Facebook, you should be able to log in as either one. You said you can search for the account and it's there. It's still there. So it's just the difference is different email addresses. So make sure you log into Faye 1 with one email address and Faye 2 with the other one, right? They have to be different addresses. If the address and the password are the same, it's the same account. What makes it your account is the email address.
Okay.
Do you have different email addresses for the...
Yeah. Right? I do. I'm sure I did in the beginning and then somehow
I... Oh, see. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes this convenience means you forget what you use to log in. Now you've got to figure that out because what's happening is the browser remembers. So this is a convenience. So you don't have to type Faye@outlook.com and the password. It just logs you in.
Right.
But you have to remember what email address you used for Faye 2 or you won't be able to get in.
That's true.
And So what you want to have is completely separate settings. Don't when you... If did you erase Firefox when you stopped using it? Did you uninstall it?
No.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. So you don't even have to install Firefox. Just make sure you clear all the information. Actually, I bet it might even remember Faye 2. Go to Facebook on Firefox, see which one you get into. If it's not the one you want, then you need to fully log out.
Mm-hmm.
And you better remember your old email.
Yeah.
Ah, that's the problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's not that you have the same phone number and password. You need the email.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Take
Thank
care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Tech Guy Show brought to you today by Qualcomm. Actually, if you're streaming this on a phone with a Qualcomm Snapdragon 845, it's quite literally brought to you by Qualcomm. You want faster data speeds, right? Who doesn't? Faster is always better. Who wants to wait for anything? Waiting in line, waiting at the bakery for your donuts, waiting for your music to download? No, faster is better. And with Qualcomm's 845 Snapdragon processor, you're getting faster. Ookla, the folks who do speed tests on that, just did an analysis of over 1 million real-world results from the speed test app. They took a look at people using people like you using AT&T and T-Mobile in real-world situations. They did it for Q2 2018. They found that Android phones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm Technologies had up to 192% faster data speeds. What? The non-Android phones with Intel modems. Unfortunately, I have a phone with the Intel modem. I also have a phone with the 845. And when I need to download something, I'm going to use the 845. 192% faster! The Snapdragon 845 mobile platform has lots of other features you may not be aware of, but they're there for you. For instance, the... third generation Qualcomm Hexagon 685 DSP built in there. It's part of the system on a chip. Has sophisticated on-device AI processing. That means, among other things, better photography. The software, we talk about computational photography. That's what's going on in there with that DSP. Richer camera images, better voice recognition, better speech, better augmented reality and virtual reality and gaming experiences, all of that improved by the system on a chip, the Qualcomm Snapdragon 845. And advanced vault-like security, the secure processing unit. It's used to store personal data, crypto keys, biometric keys. If you're using fingerprint or iris scan or face ID, all of that stuff stored in the secure processing unit. And that keeps it in isolation and away from prying eyes. Nothing can get to it. It's awesome. And, of course, it's very energy efficient. All-day battery life. Capable of up to a 50% charge in only 15 minutes. That's that Qualcomm Quick Charge. That's awesome. So check out all the data for yourself. Qualcomm.com/TWIT. Qualcomm, Qualcomm.com/TWIT. Upgrade your data speeds with a phone powered by Snapdragon 845. Qualcomm.com/TWIT. We thank them so much for their support. They wanted to reach technically literate, smart people. Guess who? You. Thank you for listening to the Tech Guy and for supporting Qualcomm. Now back to the show. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. That disco music you hear, my friends, can be a sign of only one thing. Advancing senility. No.
Crossed wires.
Crossed wires. Dick DiBartolo. We call him Mad's Maddest Writer because he's been doing that for a while. He's also the Giz Whiz, the Gizmo Wizard on the show. He brings us fun gadgets and tech each week. Hello, Dickie D.
Leo, how you doing?
I'm great. Right now, as we speak, I'm in the middle of the ocean, the Mediterranean Ocean.
Wow. Now, technology is amazing.
It's gotten better, isn't it?
How long is that cord on your microphone?
We recorded this a little bit ahead so that we could do the show, and still I could be in the middle of the ocean in the middle of the night, just off the coast of Spain.
Ooh. Very, very nice.
Now, each week, Dick goes out and looks for something fun and interesting and different. Sometimes the stuff you bring us is not so great. Sometimes
that is true.
It's amazing. Which is this?
Okay. This is amazing if you need it. Okay.
Oh.
So this was at a press event, and this woman had the sign said the NEMA sensor. And I said, what is the NEMA sensor?
NEMA, M-I-N-A. N-I-M-A. NEMA.
N-I-M-A. Okay. Exactly. So it's a little device, probably like 3 by 4 inches. And it tests, there are two versions. One tests for gluten.
Oh.
And one tests for peanuts.
Oh, my gosh.
So
I know a lot of people who this would be very useful for if you've got food allergies, right?
Absolutely. So what's different about this is you take it to the restaurant, wherever you're going, you open it up. She did a little demo of how it works, she said, but it takes like 5 or 6 minutes for the test to take place. So she sent me a link to their video. And then you take whatever you are trying to find out if there's peanuts in the cookies. So you break off a little piece. She said you could break it off from several different places.
Oh, you actually have to put it inside a little receptacle?
Inside a little capsule, okay? And then you screw the top of the capsule down. And she says that is actually grinding what you put into it. And then you put it into the device. Now, if it contains any sort of peanut, a picture of a peanut comes up.
Oh, my goodness.
If it's peanut-free, a smiley face comes up.
This actually could save lives.
This could. Yeah. And the great thing – now the peanut version was going to be out early fall, so I'm not sure exactly when. The gluten version is already out. But what I love is – I just went to their website to look around. It's NEMASensor.com. And they have – if you click on blog, they have great articles like – 10 ballparks that do not sell peanuts.
Oh, yeah, because there are people. I mean, I was on an airplane where they took our peanuts, and they said, oh, yeah, there's a kid on board who's highly allergic. Even the, you know, a peanut smell in the air could
Yeah, well, you know, Johnny Jett, who was on earlier, at one time said someone with a peanut allergy, they could get sick if someone on another flight ate peanuts through the empty bag into the seat pocket. So this is an easy way. And then they have other articles like gluten-free Chicago. So it will list restaurants that where everything there is already tested to be gluten-free.
See, now, I was thinking of using it the other way. Like, I only want to eat food that has peanuts and gluten in it.
Well, you could. If that if it comes out that way, there are three smiley faces.
Yes.
Okay, and they're all dancing.
Oh, eat more of this. It's peanut pizza. Yay! Exactly. No, I don't mean to make light of this. We have Michael has a friend who's very allergic. He has to bring an EpiPen with him. And, you know, it is a challenge. You go to a restaurant. He has to say, well, is this chicken fried in peanut oil, for instance? I mean...
Yeah, no, the woman was saying that the restaurant could say it's peanut free, but you don't know that it was near something that they put peanut.
I think nowadays restaurants are aware of this. I hope
aware.
A little more careful than they used to be. I hope.
That's right. Yeah. It's not inexpensive. The starter kit for each one is $289.
Ooh, yikes. How many tests do you get for that?
You get 12 tests.
Okay.
That can be used 12 times. And then additional capsules range from $5 to $6 for each additional test. But once you have the starter kit, then you're set. And you have to buy it for what you want. In other words, the one device doesn't test for both gluten and peanut. It will test for whatever you bought the kit for.
You don't have any food sensitivities, do you?
No, you know what? I always make sure because... You know, I don't look that healthy, but like just
you look healthy. You're actually very healthy.
Oh,
you
okay,
work out.
Okay.
Don't you work out every day? Don't you?
No. I at least walk 2.5 miles every day.
That's
and
great. Where do you go?
I go to a New York sports club. I still go to there's a gay disco that plays disco.
Wait a minute.
Old disco.
There's
music.
A disco in town.
Yes, and Tuesdays and Sunday nights they play all the old discos. So
oh
I go there.
God. Do you see people from the back in the day dancing there?
A few. it certainly skews old.
Is it called Studio 104?
Yeah. That's very funny.
Studio 74?
No, it's just called The Monster.
That sounds really fun.
It's great in Greenwich Village.
Is it like the old discos were with the lights and the fog? And
they do. They don't do fog, but they do lights. And
happened to Studio 54? Is that still around?
No, you know, it's became a nightclub.
Oh.
Actually, they divided it in half. The upper part of Studio 54 is back to being a theater for shows.
Oh, wait a minute. I saw a cabaret there.
I was just going to say, you probably, yeah.
I did. I saw, I think it was... I can't remember who was it coming. I think it was in it.
Yeah.
Oh, that was great. That was.
And then downstairs is I think it's called. It's Michael Feinstein runs the downstairs place.
So it's a
and
piano bar.
It's cabaret.
Cabaret,
exactly.
I should say. You don't
exactly.
say.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think I saw Alan Cumming in Cabaret at Studio 54.
Oh,
come to think of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah,
so he was great. He was
still alive.
Yeah, he was the MC. He wasn't. It wasn't the Liza Minnelli part. Although he probably could have done it.
He could have, yeah. Who knows? Maybe certain nights they swap parts.
I'm telling you, Monster blew it. They should have called it Studio 64.
That is very
would have been
funny.
Very good, right?
Yeah.
Or Studio 65.
Yeah.
You must be this tall to dance.
Yes. Your shoes must be this tall in order to enter.
You know, the funny thing is disco never died. They just call it EDM now. It's still...
Yeah, absolutely, boom, absolutely. Boom.
The beat's still there. I mean, people dance.
I do.
Yeah. Dick DiBartolo's website and the place to find out more about the NEMA. I'm sorry, I got sidetracked.
Oh, that's no problem.
when you said you don't look healthy, you're very healthy for a man of your advanced age.
Thank you.
You find Dick D at his, I'm sorry, at his website. We're the same age. I need a vacation. GIZWIZ.BIZ. When you go there, not only can you find information about the NEMA, But you'll also be able to play the What the Heck Is It contest, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine by Dick DiBartolo. That makes it a collector's item, something really valuable. And it's a fun game to play. You'll have fun doing it. Check it out. And don't forget his great podcast, GizWiz.tv. Dickie D, have a great week. I'll see you next time.
You too, sir. Take care. Bye.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.